Good morning. My name is Jane Freeburg-Sarma, and I'm counsel with the shipping group at Reed Smith here in New York. I have the honor of being able to moderate a very interesting panel that is not going to focus on the doom and gloom side of restructuring, but is going to take a look at restructuring as a business and investment opportunity. So maybe the flip side of that coin. And let's start with introducing our panelists. We have Espen Christensen from Alex Partners. I'm sorry, I completely blanked on your company for a second. So, next to him, we have Ivar Lihan from EY. Next to him, we have Randy Day of Golden Maritime. And next to her, we have Kevin Haggard of Miller Buckfire. So let's start things off with taking a look at what the market is. Oh, wait. Let me take another step back for one administrative thing. I've been cautioned under pain of death that we have to stay on time. So although we'll try to save time for questions at the end, life isn't a spectator sport, and neither is this panel. So if you have a question, catch my attention. We're happy to take them during the panel discussion. So let's start off with looking at the market right now. What's the hot area for restructuring? Where is there really some opportunities for finding value in companies that are having some distress? And let's just go down the panel and start with you, Espen.
Thank you, Jane. I think this is probably not a surprise for anyone, but offshore is definitely the area, the sector where we're seeing by far the most activity. Last year was onshore for oil and gas, and this year we think that it's going to be the offshore sector and really the entire ecosystem, all the way from drillers to OSV providers and the like. So from our perspective, that's going to be the area where we're going to see most activity, we think.
Ivan, is that your experience as well?
So maybe I'll throw one other thing that we're seeing is some of the niche markets, some of the companies that have, some of the niche markets that they have a diversity of ships and other routes, and so those companies are definitely on the radar of a lot of investors that we're talking to.
And one company that comes to mind when you say a company that has a lot of niche markets is one that we've seen that's in Chapter 11 right now and is working through their plan of confirmation. And I'm thinking of International Shipholding as an example of a company that has a number of different niche markets that it's been able to restructure, and it was able to get a plan through successfully. Randy, what's your perspective on where's the real hot areas in the market?
I agree with Espen. The big elephant in the room is offshore, all the way down the food chain from ultra-deep water into the OSV anchor handlers. I think you're seeing significant amounts of paper trading. You're going to be seeing huge equitization of bonds and debt. And I think similar to dry bulk, we're going to see a dramatic shift in who is the controlling shareholders of these companies. We'll be looking at a very different landscape a year and a half from now.
And Kevin, your thoughts?
Well, I'd like to have a unique area, but I agree with offshore is clearly the area that we are focusing on. I think many of the Jones Act companies have laid up ships, and obviously that's reduced supply, but there's still an oversupply in the market. I think there's a significant opportunity from an investment perspective, significant opportunity to consolidate. And those companies that are proactive with, fixing their balance sheet now will have significantly more attractive equity as they're considering merger activity in the future. And that obviously will then reduce supply going forward.
So are the real business opportunities on the debt side or on the equity side? Or is it a mix of both or depends on the company? Does anyone have a view?
I think that clearly in offshore, one of the things that is a little bit different from a lot of the commodity shipping plays is the capital structure. There's many more situations that have bonds, unsecured bonds. I think that's really driving a different restructuring dynamic. So I think that there's good opportunity, potentially in some situations to go on the debt side and equitize as a play to own, as an example, but also for ship owners as an opportunity to right-size the balance sheet and come out of this with a balance sheet that's a lot more attractive than what some of these guys are facing now. So I think that that's number one. I think number two, I agree with Kevin that in the sort of the more standardized segments of offshore, like the OSVs, the offshore support vessels, there's definitely some roll-up opportunities. There's a lot of fragmentation. These are assets that are complementary, and so I think that there's a bit of a platform opportunity for owners that are aggressive and have the right balance sheet to go pick up assets. It's very easy to lay up these types of assets. It's not that expensive. And so if you have the cash flow profile to be able to do that, I think there's some potentially interesting opportunities.
I think one of the things I think in the whole sector is we're going to see big challenges in terms of the valuations for the companies that decide to use the Chapter 11 process as a way of rehabilitating the companies. You've got, you know, you're going to have Fernleys and Clarksons have been very hesitant to come out with valuations, so it's going to be interesting to see how there's going to be adequate protection provided in a lot of these cases. I think you may see some new entrants coming in terms of if there's needed dip financing because there isn't a lot of value in the existing collateral and fleets. So I think it'll be a very interesting time, and clearly there will be, I think, large winners in both the ultra-deep water and in the OSV, the service area, due to the fact that some of the companies, even in the Gulf, have much more antiquated and older fleets and didn't do as aggressive new build programs. You can make a case that a lot of those ships, these smaller OSVs that are laid up now, will probably never trade again. Anything that's approaching 15 years plus is probably going to be scrapped.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely a great point about valuation is completely uncertain. I think the other challenge is companies have, a fair amount of the companies have significant liquidity and don't have an impetus to enter into a restructuring dialogue. Companies are significantly over-levered, but they have 2 or 3 years of runway, and it makes sense as the equity owner to say, geez, I think I can get through the downturn and maintain ownership of this company. Why do I want to delever now? And so a lot of restructurings have been pushed off for the near term because of liquidity and no near-term maturities. And when they ultimately do get to that, I think there is a huge question is what is the value of these vessels?
Yeah, and the other thing I would add is we're seeing a lot more interest from the banks because last year the bid-ask spread was enormous, and we're seeing that the banks are now willing to take more of a haircut than they have in the past, and a lot of this following from the AQR, from the reviews in 2014, that the banks have now had time over the last, 8 years of this crisis to start, figuring out, where their provisions are and where their loans are. So we're seeing a lot more interest in the banks to move their, move their facilities.
Are you seeing interest in banks in stepping in to provide new financing, or is it restructuring existing financing, or just simply writing down the loans and taking the loss?
Well, I think that's on individual banks, and I think everybody. I mean, a few of the banks have been just getting out of the market altogether, just completely. Have been trying to just get rid of their portfolio as a whole, and we're seeing others that are, I wouldn't say necessarily putting in new money, but looking at ways to make it easier for the company to get to the next level or to work through the difficult times.
Yeah, I think we have seen lenders not being willing to put new money up per se in traditional sense, maybe with the exception of dip financing. We've seen some lenders being willing to do that as a defensive measure to be at the table, a part of a restructuring. If it's a Chapter 11 scenario, We've also seen in the more specialized offshore sectors like drilling, ultra-deepwater drilling, where the assets are so far underwater and the cost of laying assets up is so significant, we've seen lenders being willing to being much more flexible in terms of reinvesting cash that would otherwise go to debt service into reserve funds for layup costs or whatever it might be, in an attempt to just try and not end up with the assets. Because for some of these banks, ending up with a fifth or sixth generation drill rig is really not something that's in the cards for them. So we're seeing a little bit more flexibility than we are in other sectors because of some of those drivers.
I'll also just add to that, I think, we spend a lot of time visiting with a lot of large funds and PE firms and hedge funds and, distressed investors. And to his point, I think what they're really having trouble with is not just looking at an asset whose value is eroded by at least, 50% on the large deep water ships, but you've got these stacking costs and trying to decide you're going to cold stack, you're going to warm stack. How is it going to be 1 year, 3 years? What is the viability of a unit that by then might be 7 years old, and will it be employable? If you're BP and you're looking for a unit 4 years from now, are you going to choose, a deep water ship that's been laid up for 7 or 8 years and take a risk out in the U.S. Gulf, or are you going to, choose a newer vessel? So there could be a class of, assets that originally cost, $700 million that their value is, I think, quite questionable, and that has made a lot of potential investors and funds be quite hesitant as to what the additional negative carry they would have in this sort of an investment.
Just getting back on the banks point, I absolutely agree with the U.S. banks are proactive in right-sizing the investment, writing it down to the appropriate valuation. I would say on the European banks that we've dealt with are more focused on maintaining their principal and providing the company with significant flexibility in the capital structure on interest and amortization, so as they're avoiding really writing down the loan and trying to kind of see to the next another day. So that's really the thought on the banks.
Do you see any lenders sort of taking proactive steps to avoid a freefall bankruptcy at all costs, or is it more the lenders are now viewing bankruptcy as more of a tool, or what's sort of your sense of how lenders are treating U.S. bankruptcy?
Yeah, I think let me take it first from the company's perspective. I think companies are right to be proactive early. I think a lot of the Jones Act, offshore guys have hired advisors and are considering alternatives, exchange, and have significant runway to get to what the right transaction might be. And so that's great. I think from the lender perspective, oftentimes they're not, the company's in compliance with covenants and they're in the dark and not able to really act. When they do get a covenant, they are, the ones I've seen have been proactive in saying, we need to figure out what the long-term solution is here.
I also think that you have a lot of cases. I know the U.S. banks are under some pressure because evidently there's some accounting guidelines in the whole energy and E&P area, which I'm sure everybody at this table knows. And so I think they have been quicker, especially the regional banks, and then a lot of them have done sale leasebacks on this equipment, and I think they've already written those down to scrap, which I think makes a lot of sense. I think you're probably going to see in the next year a few more pre-pack bankruptcies, and I think the banks will be very active in that in terms of whether or not they fund the dip or you have outside investors funding the dip. But I think in all cases, the companies that come out of this is going to be massive deleveraging like we saw in dry bulk. And the ones that are delevered will be the winners, and the ones that didn't do sufficient delevering will be potentially the targets.
I would agree with everything that was said, as well as, we're also getting requests to do contingency planning. So looking at the different scenarios, looking at different jurisdictions, looking at you know, from a company side, what are the alternatives? Because then looking to be proactive to take it to the lenders and say, okay, listen, here's where we are. We think our business plan is viable. We do think we are bringing something to the table as the owner. You know, we don't think this, you know, that we should go by the wayside. We understand what we're good at, where the value is, and we, and presenting that and looking at the different alternatives, which might be a pre-pack, which might be a filing, which might just be an out-of-court restructuring. So we are definitely seeing a lot more of that.
And I guess just to answer the question as well, I think that for the most part, the old sort of, you know, we're the ship owner, and if you don't cooperate, we'll file for Chapter 11 threat. I don't think that that is quite as powerful as it used to be. We are seeing lots of lenders that are getting more comfortable with Chapter 11. You know, there's been a number of cases, you know, good and bad. And so I think that that in of itself, I don't think is something that is a huge chip anymore necessarily for a ship owner to threaten a Chapter 11.
You had a lot of the European banks that are involved in the offshore area were had huge exposures when crude went through problems back in 2011, 2012, and then the dry bulk. They were in a lot of those loans, and many of those big companies did go through bankruptcy and emerge successfully. So I think it's not as difficult for them to understand what's involved in the process as it was back, you know, 5 or 6 years ago.
Jane, you mentioned, you know, either debt investment or equity. I would just say for the sponsors in the room, to give you an example, there's absolutely an opportunity to invest in restructured companies. An example would be we just got a prepackaged plan confirmed for Ultra Petrol, and the old equity is the new investor, right? So they're able to buy. We ran a complete sale process. Theirs was the highest and best bid. They're investing in a completely restructured balance sheet, completely delevered, no debt on the river business, you know, able to really see a much lower value and therefore a lot of opportunity for them. So there's always an opportunity on the equity side as well once the balance sheet's cleaned up.
Well, that's a very interesting point that you just brought up of Ultra Petrol's being able to use the bankruptcy process to clear out its balance sheet to get rid of that debt and to emerge as really a stronger company. Are there any other features, like in a Chapter 11 process, that can be used as a tool by a company that's looking to really transform itself and getting out of bankruptcy? Are there any other examples that we can share?
Well, I think you mentioned International Ship Holding. They ran a process prior to bankruptcy and were not able to get to a deal and filed without a plan, but were able to use sort of the structure and the framework and the protections that the filing, the process affords to double down on running a process. And, you know, they're not haven't emerged yet, but, you know, all the fingers crossed are that they will soon with a plan that allowed them the time to get a sale process going as well, and also to get a dip financing put in place and get people interested in actually, you know, helping them with what was becoming a pretty significant liquidity issue at the onset of that case.
You can through the process, you can reset a lot of covenants, and I think it's been noticed in the dry bulk and a lot of the restructurings that went through bankruptcy had initially some pretty stringent covenants on ship sales that after the restructuring, 100% of any ship sales had to go towards either paying a balloon or principal that was out several years. And I think through that process, the banks have begun to realize that if the owner needs to continue to sell ships to maintain the liquidity, to trade its fleet and maintain the commercial viability, that allowing them to dispose of older tonnage and to use that as a liquidity buffer is also helpful. So that on top of a lot of cost, some good G&A management, and oftentimes you've seen changes in both executive management and perhaps technical operators shifting from this pool didn't perform as well. You get new boards in there that can take a close look at this on an independent and fresh basis. And I think some, you know, good positive things can come out out of companies that go through this with a well-orchestrated, well-thought-out process.
Yeah, I would just add that in those less familiar with the restructuring or Chapter 11 process, there's an opportunity for the company to look at executory contracts and reject them. So, for example, the company might have significant new building contracts that they're on the hook for that they don't want to purchase going forward. If the company is in bankruptcy, they can seek to reject those contracts. It'll cause an unsecured claim in most cases against the company's balance sheet, but that would get restructured in the entire process. And again, you kind of can emerge clean from those obligations.
So those are some really interesting things that you can do within the context of a restructuring that you may not be able to do outside of a restructuring. And those can all have very positive effects on a company's balance sheets. Now let's look, I said this wouldn't be a gloom and doom scenario, but let's look at the flip side for a little bit and look at some of the potential pitfalls in restructuring, particularly from an investor side. What are some of the pitfalls that going into restructuring that might be looming there or might be hidden pitfalls that that an investor would be wise to be wary of?
Well, generally, the existing equity is oftentimes wiped out, and especially if the banks are delevering, and then you have the bondholders and the large secured creditors may need to equitize their exposure, and you have a dramatic shift in not only the shareholding base but also generally in completely new boards. And an entire shift in management. Often cases, you may have to put in a CRO or an interim executive officer, and you could have a different change in the ultimate strategy of the company.
Yeah, I also think we've had a restructuring panel here now for many years, and shipping is volatile, and that seems to imply that it goes up and down, but it has definitely, for the most part, been a down market. And so I think if you're an investor looking at this space, there are many investors that's come before you that's had, maybe too optimistic expectations around the market turn up or haven't been able to create a platform that is, from a balance sheet perspective, has the resiliency to withstand an extended downturn. So I think... if it looks like it's too good of an investment, then it probably is. And so I think the due diligence piece is really, really critical for anyone who is on the outside looking in.
Yeah, and I would jump on that is, a lot of these companies are going through second waves of bankruptcies, and the bankruptcy process, it does clean up the balance sheet, it does sort of right size, but it doesn't always fix the underlying business issue or the management issue or, some of the things that led you into bankruptcy aside from being overlevered. And so I think we often talk to investors that are weary of that because, you think it fixes everything, but it doesn't if there are fundamental issues with the business.
And I'll just hit on something Randy mentioned at the very beginning is valuation, right? So as a fund or a bank that might be investing in the capital structure, you're buying at 60 cents on the dollar and you think you're going to get 80 in the restructuring, maybe get the equity. All that obviously is premised on what is the value of the company that, there's a lot of uncertainty related to the asset value. What's the company's business plan? All the companies that we're talking to, you have a short term, what 17 looks like, 18, 19, 20. There's a lot of uncertainty. When does the turnaround happen? And obviously, as you're valuing cash flows, that's a very wide discrepancy in terms of, what your 60 cents on the dollar investment is in the bonds is gonna come back at the end of a restructuring.
Right. Not to mention that you have different fleets, different vintages, which will affect different investors and different bondholders at various points in the... So, that's always an issue as well.
One very high-profile bankruptcy that we saw over the last year was the bankruptcy of Hanjin, which many thought was too big to fail. And obviously that was not the case. Is too big to fail a viable concept in shipping, or is there really no such thing and any company could be finding itself in Chapter 11?
I think it's, you know, no different than Lehman Brothers. I mean, there's no such thing as too big to fail. And, you know, I think Hanjin was a case of, you know, they had very little help and review, whereas, you know, HMM had, I believe they'd retained advisors and U.S. lawyers and looked at a lot of options. And they just found themselves in a free fall situation that, you know, created obviously a tremendous problem, and we'll still see the result of that with certain of the charterers, the independent ship owners that had tremendous exposure to them. You know, I'm not going to name any, but we all know who some of them are, where maybe 30% of their fleet was on those sort of charters. And I think what it'll do is hopefully companies will start to look at their strategies of, should I ever have 30% of my fleet on charter to one entity, even though it seems like it's a really solid, you know, quasi-sovereign risk, and what is the risk associated with that? And I think you may see people rethinking that that strategy.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, and I think to me there were sort of three key takeaways from Hanjin. You know, Ivan mentioned the contingency planning. You know, from the outside view in, this to me looked like a situation where there was very little contingency planning, or at least any very little plan B planning, and so not a very good job at considering, you know, venue, jurisdiction, process, strategy for restructuring. So number two, I think, for container shipping, unlike some of the other sectors that we're covering, the complexity of the liner operation and how far-reaching it is in terms of the ecosystem, I think was something that surprised a lot of people, everything from shippers to tonnage providers, drayage providers, and the like. And I think the last piece, which I think is the hopeful piece, if you will, the optimistic piece, is that all of those challenges aside, and the size and the lack of planning for the Hanjin restructuring or wind-up, it didn't take that long for the system to work and come up with solutions to get the freight moving and get the vessels discharged. And so I think that there's a lot of learnings, lessons from that process, but I think there's also a lot of solutions that I think other companies that may or may not be considering something like this or may need it in the future can benefit from.
So I will just piggyback on all this, is that what I was going to say is one thing I would add is that a big failure like a Hanjin and something that, you know, it really does also affect the financial markets as well, which also put a heightened sense of scrutiny on, you know, what's going on and if they are too big to fail. And then what we saw, which I agree, is, you know, when you go quickly into these free falls, if you don't have the proper planning, right, so you could have alleviated a lot of those issues if all this stuff was planned beforehand, if you understood where all the ships were and what was on the ships, and you can, you know, we've all done this, you can go to the courts and get all this approved and figure out a way to get it done in a reasonable manner without all the issues. So I think I agree that, you know, proper planning and lessons learned are helpful.
Okay, we've got just a few minutes left. I am going to jump in and tell a personal story about Hanjin. As a restructuring lawyer in shipping, I have a very difficult time explaining to my children what I actually do. But we were at the beach this summer, and we saw a Hanjin ship just parked outside of one of the Jersey Shore beaches. And so I was able to at least point to that and say, look, the mom's working on that. Don't worry. But anyway... we have just a couple minutes left, and so if anyone has any questions, we have one here.
Thank you for taking my question. My name is Andrea Psoris, and I'm a locally based bank analyst. In Europe, and I'm a little curious perhaps because I know somewhat of the regulatory regime there is a little different, and meanwhile, the European banks aren't doing very well, so perhaps... they can't afford to take provisions to be able to start charging off on these loans, number one, and then number two, perhaps their regulators aren't really requiring them because of the difficulties that the European banks are having, and so the regulators aren't really forcing them to take write-downs? Or number three, is it because the owners have relationships with the bankers that go back a very long time, and the bankers are really reluctant to force the owners to face, you know, calls on loans and bankruptcy or whatever's in legal framework over there is entailed with write-downs? So have at it, please.
Yeah, I can start. I think it's very situational, meaning, you know, there are different banks that have different constraints, but there's definitely banks in Europe that have regulatory constraints to take write-downs, and so there's a process issue that whether or not they want to do it is sort of irrelevant. So that is an issue. I think you also have other banks in Europe that have balance sheets that are just where they have systemic issues or concerns that write-downs, even to this day, can result in sort of a knock-on effect. And whether or not that's perceived or reality is also a bit irrelevant when you're dealing with a specific credit. So I think it really depends on the bank. But I think one of the problems that we find ourselves a lot is when you have a syndicate in a deal and you have a variety of banks, you know, you may find all you need is, depending on how your loan docs are put together, is one bank who has this constraint. And you have a whole set of options that may not be available or be very difficult to tap into to get to something that's consensual or that works for all parties.
Yeah, I was just going to add, I think it's a bit of all the above. So it all very much depends. And we're seeing all the different scenarios. And we also, the banks are concerned that there's going to be a follow-up review on some of the shipping loans. So they are, as I said, I mean, at least the ones we're talking, they're being very proactive on managing, you know, their positions.
I also think, as my good friend Michael Parker would remember from the 80s, you know, I think the fact that so many of the banks themselves have such issues in terms of their adequate capitalization ratios that they, per Esmond's point, which I think was very interesting, is that back in the 80s, a lot of the big banks were able to buy out our troubled syndicate members who were holding out, you know, because we had the capacity to do that, and then you could control the restructuring. You could take a profit share in the fleet. You could take the upside residual. There was a lot more flexibility, but I think it was because the banks just had very solid balance sheets then, and we're not finding that, particularly what we see in Europe and Germany and, you know, the RBS situation in London, where they're really almost forced to be liquidating substantial amounts of their loan assets in this sector.
I know we're out of time, but really quickly, I think I agree it's all of the above. I would say, you know, there is some more flexibility in the European regulatory regime. Obviously, if you're the bank, you're saying, I don't want to take the write down if I'm able not to. So that's how they're able to keep their principal outstanding.
Well, I'd like to thank all the members of our panel for a very lively and interesting discussion.